Welcome to Sharkpedia. We're your hosts, Megan
and Imani,
a couple of shark researchers that want to bring the science to you.
We're creating a space to learn all things sharks
and their relatives,
answer your questions,
and learn from the legends in the field.
Get ready to jump in.
Let's dive deep into the world of sharks.
Welcome back, Sharkies, to Sharkpedia. This is Imani and Megan.
Hey, Sharkies!
We are so excited this week to have Dr. Bernat here to talk about parasites and sharks. Dr. Bernat, would you please introduce yourself?
Hi, everybody. My name is Jimmy Bernat, and I'm a postdoc researcher at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., and I've been studying parasites for about the last 10 years. Tapeworms that live in sharks, and also copepods that live on sharks and some other fish.
So cool. I have so many questions for you about parasites in general, so I'm really excited to talk about the paper we have with you today.
Yeah, next time I go down to DC and go to the Smithsonian, so I'm going to be like, where's Dr. Bernat? Talk to me about tapeworms.
Yeah, send me a message. I could give you a behind-the-scenes tour. Yeah, absolutely.
Are you one of those parasite biologist that has like jars of parasites everywhere?
Yes. I just moved. So they're currently in boxes like next to my desk right now. But a lot of times if I'm doing things like this or like Skype a scientist or something, I'll be like holding vials up to my web camera so people can see like a copepod or a tapeworm or something.
Yes. So cool. All right. So without further ado, Megan is going to go ahead and introduce the paper that is going to be the base of our conversation today.
Yes. Okay. So we are breaking down one of Dr. Bernat's papers that he's authored titled A New Species of Pseudopandarus Copepod that is from sharks of the genus Squalus in New Caledonian waters. In this article, Dr. Bernat and Dr. Bockshell describe the parasitic copepod Pseudopandarus chirai, the first parasitic copepod to be described for two host species of shark, the big-head spurdog Squalus bucephalus and the black-tailed spurdog Squalus melanurus. This is the first record of the species of copepod found on a species of shark in the order Squaliforms. So Squaliforms are a lot of those dogfish-type sharks. And not only this, but it's the first time a male copepod of the species has been described, which I'm super excited to ask you. I have a lot of questions about that. But not only this, it's the first time this article gives a very in-depth description of the copepod itself and how to distinguish it from other closely related copepod species. So before we break down exactly, you know, the methods and everything about this article, Dr. Bernat, I have some just general questions for you. What is it like studying parasites? Because I have like an image in my head of what that life might be like, but I'd like for you to just kind of describe to us, you know, what does your day look like studying parasites?
Sure. Well, these days it looks like probably most people's jobs these days, which is like working from home in front of a computer. And even when I'm going into a lab, I'm, you know, typically working at a computer most of the time, but I also spend a lot of time at a microscope. And a few times a year, I spend, you know, maybe a week or two in the field actually collecting sharks or other fish and looking at them for parasites. I'll usually preserve them and bring them back to the lab in like small vials. And so I'll just have like drawers with rows of small vials, and I'll be putting those specimens that I've collected under microscopes to look at them and see, to identify them and maybe do some DNA sequencing as well. And so a lot of times I work with fishermen because they are really the best people at catching any sort of fish, sharks included. And a lot of times these, especially small sharks, are bycatch. So fishermen are putting out like long lines. They might be fishing for particular types of deep sea fish, but they'll occasionally catch sharks. And they would typically throw those overboard, but we'll talk to them beforehand and say, hey, if you catch any of these sharks, can you keep them for us when you come back to the dock? A lot of times they've been sitting on these long lines underwater for like a day or two. They're frequently dead already. So then we'll process those and identify parasites and do some genetic work on the sharks or the fish they catch too. So kind of making the most of what we can from any specimen we get.
Oh, that's really great.
So this is a question that just popped into my head from what you said. Do the parasites stay on the shark's body or fish's body after they die?
Yeah, really good question. And it generally depends on the group of parasites. So in the case of copepods, some of them probably do fall off of their host when the host dies. But for the most part, they can remain pretty firmly attached and they don't really want to leave their host because that's where all their food is. So they will stay there. Some things like I used to work on shark tapeworms, obviously those can't really like get out, but a problem is the digestive tract of organisms is like the first thing that starts to break down when the shark dies. And so if that shark, you know, if it was like a deep sea trawler that like caught that shark and then that's been sitting on the boat for like a few days before they get back to the dock, sometimes the tapeworms will have like rotted, basically, like they'll be digested and kind of broken down with everything else inside the intestine. So you often need to get the, like, you know, the sharks pretty fresh to be able to work on their parasites.
Do you find that certain species of sharks have a lot more parasites? And I preface this question with a little bit of a backstory, which is, you know, I also fish for sharks and study them. And when we pull up, we have spiny dogfish, which is in that order Squaliforms, and on the Pacific coastline. And they are, I mean, I don't understand how they continue to thrive when they have like hundreds and hundreds of parasites on these dogfish, which I don't see on other species. So I'm curious, like, do you find that also? Do you find that some species of sharks will just carry more parasites?
Yeah, that does seem to be the case. Well, first I'll say some individuals just carry a lot of parasites and we don't really know why that is, but sometimes, like, you know, you'll look at, say, five sharks and four of them will each have like one or two or three or four or five copepods. And then maybe one of them will have like 30, you know? And so it's like, what's going on in this one individual that has a lot more parasites than the other?
Well, they didn't wake up and take a shower.
They could have like a weakened immune system, or, you know, there could be something else going on, but there is this general trend in parasitology that like most hosts have a few parasites, but then there's a small number of hosts in each species that have a lot. But back to your question, yes, some sharks do have more parasites than others. It's difficult for me to generalize because of that variation between like individuals, you know, so you might just get like lucky or unlucky and catch one individual of one species that happens to be like loaded with parasites. But I'll say like, it's very surprising to me. Sometimes you catch a shark and it's like this like emaciated, like scraggly looking thing. And you're going to be like, oh, this thing's full of parasites and it has none. And it's unhealthy for some other reason. And then you'll find like a big, you know, heavy, strong adult female shark and it's loaded with parasites. So it's difficult to say until you look closely. There's definitely one pattern that like the longer something has been alive, like if it's an older shark, it's had more time to pick up more parasites. So you can see some general trends like that. And the fact that deep sea sharks tend to have less parasites, probably because, you know, you think of the deep sea or like the open ocean as being like a desert. There's not very much going on there. There's like, you know, large distances between any individual animal swimming around there. And so it's hard for parasites to build up into like large numbers on these like deep sea species of sharks.
Cool.
That is really cool. And I have another kind of general question. Do you find that like any given shark have a certain number of, not number like in abundance, but do they have lots of different species of parasites on them?
Yes. And it's hard to, you know, it's challenging to get that sort of total because people that work on parasites tend to specialize on one group of parasites. So if I'm looking for tapeworms on a shark, I'm really only going to be looking in the shark's intestine. Whereas if I'm looking for copepods on a shark, I'm going to be looking on its skin and on its gills and maybe in its nostrils. And somebody that's working on monogenians, which are these like flatworms that live on parasites, they usually live only on the skin or gills. So people like specialize in different parasites that live in different areas. But I've been a part of some parasite surveys, that like one in Australia that was awesome with a guy named Tom Cribb. He led this study where we basically had like an assembly line of parasitologists. And so like every fish that we looked at, like, okay, the intestine goes to the person looking for tapeworms, and
supply chain.
Yes. And all of the fish heads went to me and Jeff, because we were looking for copepods on their gills and in their mouth. And then somebody else took blood to look for, you know, blood pathogens. And, you know, so it was broken up like that to assembly line all of these animals. And it worked out great because, again, it was like maximizing what you get from any individual fish or shark that you catch. The hard thing is if you wanted to look at like all the parasites on a single shark, and you have to look at all the different organs, because different parasites live in different organs, it would take a team of two or three people like well over 2 hours to do that just for one shark. Meanwhile, the other ones would be like spoiling, you know, like warming up. And, you know, so you often have to just like triage things and be like, okay, we're going to focus on the things that we know might be interesting on this shark. Or I'm working on copepods, so I'm going to look mostly at the gills or the skin.
Oh my gosh, really cool. That's so cool. So from what you just said, parasites are selective on where they might live or attach to in a shark or other fish. I'm curious if they are also selective of what type of shark, for example, that they attach to. And I'm kind of curious like what those things that they're selective about might be, if that's the case.
Yeah, so definitely. And so in parasitology, we call that like host specificity. So how specific is this parasite for the different types of hosts it lives on? And that varies just from individual parasites. So I used to work on shark tapeworms. They are known for being incredibly host specific. Usually each shark tapeworm lives in only a single species of shark, which is really astounding when you think about it, because, you know, they're going to be encountering other species of shark that live in that habitat, but for some reason they never like persist on that, those other species, except for their like one host species. And we don't really know why. It could be an immune system thing. It could be a microbiome system thing, but we don't really know. So I came from that area with like super host specific tapeworms to work on copepods. And this was the paper we're looking at, is the very first copepod that I worked on. And I was like so blown away that this copepod was found on sharks in two different orders of copepod. This copepod was found on sharks in two different shark orders, which is like really surprising to me. But this is kind of known as more of a generalist parasite. They can live on lots of different shark species. And maybe that's because it's an ectoparasite, like it's just attaching to shark scales. And so its legs are probably pretty good at attaching to shark scales, kind of no matter what the shark species is, as long as they're, you know, somewhat similar.
And I know in the paper you talked about how they might acquire parasites by schooling together and potentially bumping into each other. But can you just describe in general how might a shark species pick up a parasite, especially something like a tapeworm when it's so specific to the species? Like, how do they come across all these parasites?
Yeah, so a lot of the parasites that live inside sharks, like the tapeworms, those are all transmitted through the food web. So they have larval stages that are in things that sharks are eating. And so sharks just like pick them up passively. They might eat a hermit crab or a clam or a shrimp that has like a larval tapeworm in it. And then when that gets into a suitable host, the tapeworm will develop. So that's unusual. Like in the group of sharks I worked on in my master's, there were three species in the genus Mustelis living in the same area. They're all generalists. They're all eating kind of whatever they can find. So they must be encountering larval tapeworms of each other's tapeworm species, but we never found those tapeworm species in different shark species, even though the sharks were really closely related. So that was very surprising to me. And we still don't really know why that is. For the copepods, they actively look for their shark hosts. So they have larval stages, but their larval stages are like little torpedoes. They like swim around looking for sharks and then attaching to them. So they can search out like a suitable shark. They can't swim as fast as a shark, so they're probably not like really like darting after a shark. But if a shark is swimming slowly, or if the shark bumps into one of them, they will latch on and attach, and then they'll like molt and develop into an adult. So one of my theories kind of that I just like touched on in this paper, since we were finding these copepods on two different orders of sharks, we know that like some Carcharhiniform sharks like Mustelis and Triacus sometimes school with squaliform sharks like Squalus. They're pretty similar. I mean, Mustelis and Squalus are both called like dogfish. One's like a smooth dogfish and one's a spiny dogfish. And they are about the same size. They both are sort of shallow bottom dwelling sharks. And so just like birds might travel in mixed flocks, these sharks can travel in mixed schools. And so then it's not so surprising that maybe these copepods that are swimming around looking for a shark hop onto a different shark that's swimming around the same area, and they're still able to survive there and do pretty well.
Sharks that swim together share parasites together.
What a club to be a part of.
You want to be my friend? Gosh. I have another little friend to share with you.
Your social circle must be very large. So copepods are not large, right? Like their relative size in comparison to the ocean and a shark is like not big, right? So for like their larval stages, for example, if they're just like floating around in the ocean with the likelihood that a shark would swim into them or close enough to them, does that mean that their larval stage is like super long, or do they only have a certain amount of time to find a host?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So yeah, just for reference, these copepods that I described are considered kind of big copepods, and they were, you know, just under like a centimeter long. So kind of
big.
Small. Yeah. You know, maybe about the length of like your like little pinky fingernail or something, mm-hmm. or a little smaller. So that's considered big for a copepod. There are others that are like a sesame seed sized or smaller. So how do they, was the question, how do they like find their sharks? And
I guess the question is like, in terms of survival, super curious, like, since it's not like they're that large, I'm assuming that ocean water is significantly viscous to them. Like, how do they even get near a shark if they're like, say, floating around in the open ocean and they're not sitting on a reef where sharks are coming in and out all the time?
Yeah, right. Great question. So, and very insightful. So there's free living copepods and parasitic copepods. And one of the biggest differences is the parasitic copepods produce a ton more eggs. And it's just to get around this challenge that you're mentioning, that it's really hard to find a host. So they produce a lot more eggs to give a chance that some of their offspring, you know, do find a host. And the advantage of what like being a parasite is, if you're one of the lucky ones that can find a host, you are living on a food source that is like thousands of times bigger than you. So you can afford to just like grow big and eat a ton and put a ton of your energy then into reproduction and making like many hundreds or thousands of babies. So that's one thing these copepods do. They have a lot of babies, and they give their babies a lot of yolk, so that their larvae, when they hatch, don't need to eat anything. They have sufficient yolk that they can survive for days or perhaps weeks at a time, kind of drifting around, hoping to encounter a suitable host. So basically the mother copepod that's on this shark and has all the food she could ever want invests a lot of energy into her babies to give them a chance to find a host. And they do certain things, like the larvae will hang out in areas where they're more likely to encounter their hosts. So for these bottom dwelling sharks, I don't know this for sure, but I would suspect that the larvae kind of hang out closer to the ocean bottom, where copepods that live on salmon, their larvae tend to hang out in surface waters where they're more likely to encounter salmon, for instance. And they probably will swim towards a host. They can, smell basically a host, and so they can kind of do some swimming and seek them out.
That's so cool. I didn't even realize they could smell. I was just imagining like a little copepod with binoculars or something being like, oh look, there's a shark, I will swim towards you. Or like that scene in Finding Nemo where she thinks she sees a whale from like super far away and they're swimming towards it and it gets like larger and larger. That's exactly what I was imagining.
Yeah, and I'm saying smell, but they don't smell the way we do. Like they have little antenna, kind of like like an insect's antenna, and they have little sensory structures on that they can use to like detect chemicals in the water. And that's probably how they detect their host, and it's definitely how they detect their mates. So males can search out females, and they basically can like smell the females in the water, and they will follow like the scent of a female to find her.
That is a perfect lead up to my next question, which is that you say in the article that you typically only find females. So it was a really big deal that you saw a male copepod on this shark during your study. So why aren't the males there? Where are the males? What's going on with that? And if they're not on the host species, when do they reproduce?
Yeah, good question. So it could be that there's just like a sex bias in copepods. That's possible. I know it's true in some copepods. I'm not sure if it's true in these, but it could be that like when the eggs hatch, it's not like 50-50 males, females. Maybe it's like 3/4 females and 1/4 male. Or it could be that the females just spend more time on their hosts. And it might be a combination of these two. We really know the females spend more time on their host because in this species and in many parasitic copepods, the females are really modified for attaching to their host and for producing tons of babies like we just talked about. And so the females, by the time they've developed on a host, they're no longer good at swimming anymore. They can't really like leave their shark host and find another shark. But the males look very different and they aren't as modified for attachment. They still have legs that have these structures on them that are kind of like small paddles that make them much better at swimming through the water. And so we know that the males are more able to swim off of a host and potentially find another. And that could be because if a male copepod finds a shark and there's no females on it, that doesn't really do him any good. So he would need to be able to leave that shark to search out another shark that might have females on it. And the males are sometimes collected in plankton samples. And so we know there's kind of swimming around to look for hosts that have a female on it.
Oh, that's cool. That makes total sense. And yeah, so basically the females just hang out on the shark, and the males do the work of finding the females.
Exactly. Yeah. And it would make sense from like an evolutionary perspective to potentially have like a sex ratio bias. Now, I'm not sure if that's the case for these copepods, but we know in some other copepods, they do have these like uneven sex ratios with more females than males. And that's because like, say there's 10 female copepods on one shark. If one male gets there, he can mate and fertilize all 10 females. It's not like you need, 10 males to fertilize the 10 females. And so there could be like a bias in the number of males and females potentially. And I will say, because it's just kind of interesting, copepods have a cool mating system where the males make a packet of sperm called a spermatophore, and they just glue that on to the female. And so then the female has like a package of sperm on her that she can use to produce a clutch of eggs. And I think they might even be able to produce multiple clutches of eggs with a single pack of sperm. So it's kind of like an efficient way of like handing over they basically glue on a basket of sperm onto the female. Yeah.
Merry Christmas. Here you go.
And then can the female hold like multiple packets from different males?
That is a good question. It looks like the males will kind of compete. They might try to like remove another male's sperm packet, but it's pretty hard because they really do like cement these things on. And I haven't seen it myself, but Jeff, who's Dr. Bakshal, who's looked at way more parasitic copepods than I have. He's like the leading expert on parasitic copepods in the world. He said you can sometimes see like a mark left over by like an earlier sperm packet on a female, like a previous spermatophore. Yeah.
Someone needs to make a glue called copepod glue and sell that.
As long as you don't call it spermatophore glue.
Yeah.
There are people, maybe not looking specifically at copepods, but, you know, barnacles make these like underwater glues that would have like really great properties for things like patching maybe a ship hull underwater, or like, you know, what is it like getting like a filling in your tooth, you know, these like, it's pretty rare to find glues that like dry very well and are very strong in a like, you know, aqueous environment. And so, you know, copepods do that with their little sperm packets, and barnacles and some other crustaceans also make these like really strong underwater glues.
That's so cool. There's a whole line. There's like a whole industry potential here for, for underwater glues.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. So another thing that I was really curious about is that you and the methods describe how you drew and described this copepod. So that's something that I'm not familiar with. I don't typically have to do that in the line of work that I do. So I was so curious, do taxonomists generally draw their own things that they're describing, or do you hire somebody to help you draw those images, or like, what is that process like? Cause that's something I have never even had to think about.
Yeah. People do both. A lot of taxonomists do their own illustrations. And there aren't as many, I think, like full-time scientific illustrators as there used to be. And most museums will still might have a person in like the botany department that will do like amazing, like full color images. I love botanic artwork. I certainly can't make illustrations like those. These people will, you know, do painting and acrylics or like watercolors and all sorts of things to make like amazing lifelike illustrations. I do a lot more simple things than that. And I use like pen and ink illustrations. So kind of like an architect's pens. And that's a pretty like classic way to do scientific illustrations for taxonomy of like invertebrates. So I do my own illustrations. It's one of my favorite parts of my job because it's kind of rare to be able to like mix in sort of art with your science. And people ask me a lot, like, how do you do that? Do you have to be a good illustrator? And I mean, you definitely learn as you go, but really it's more about tracing than anything else, right? Because if you were just like sketching what you saw, that could be problematic, because if you just do things in like slightly inaccurate proportions, like somebody else could find another species and be like, could find your same species and be like, oh, this is different because it's proportionally a little bit different than the drawing that you made. So you have to like really, really focus on accuracy in these scientific illustrations and how it works for these. Yeah. No, but it's really so cool. It's really cool. How it works for these copepods and for tapeworms and lots of small invertebrates is you work at a microscope that has a thing called a drawing tube on it. Sometimes they're called a camera lucida, which is like a fancy word for sort of the same thing. And it's like a little like periscope attached to your microscope. And so when you flip this little, it's basically a series of mirrors. You flip those mirrors and then you put a piece of paper and your pencil under the mirrors, like on your table, just next to your microscope. And now when you look into the eyepieces of your microscope, you see the specimen you're looking at, and you also see like a faint view of your hand and the pencil that you're holding inside the microscope.
Oh my gosh.
So it's kind of weird. It sort of feels like, you know, like rubbing your belly and patting your head at the same time. It takes a little getting,
no kidding.
It takes a little getting used to, but when you get good at it, you just trace what you see in the microscope. So you're looking in the microscope, you see your specimen and you see your hand inside the microscope, and you just draw what you see, you trace it. So everything is proportional. And I'll do these drawings really big. I could show you them, but your listeners wouldn't see it. And also they're still like packed in boxes because I just moved last weekend. But I'll do the drawings really big initially. They might take up like 2 or 3 full-size sheets of paper. And so then I can be like super accurate, have all the details, and then I'll use like a photocopier to like scan and reduce those in size. And then I'll use pen and ink again to trace over my like pencil sketches to make like a really accurate, clean looking final drawing. And people often ask me like, why do you do these drawings instead of just taking a photograph? And photographs are useful, but the problem is these specimens are really like three-dimensional things. And so it's hard to get, like, you can't get everything in focus in a single photograph. And since I'm really used to looking at these copepods, I can do a lot of like the interpretation work. So, you know, for instance, their legs overlap. So in a photograph, you would only see the top leg and not the two other legs that are covered by it. But in a microscope, you can focus through on just the leg you want to draw. And then I can very accurately draw all the details of that leg that are really important without you having to see like the two other legs stacked on top that might have been covering a lot of those structures. And then you can also take like a little bit of artistic license to maybe highlight, like not highlight, but use a thicker pen or something like that to show, oh, this little spine here, this little nub here is really important. That's unique to this species. Yeah.
As someone, face is priceless. So I spent 4 years of my undergrad in a paleoceanography lab, and I picked forams out of sediment samples. So as someone who understands how hard it is to stay looking through a microscope for extended periods of time, I am just like shook that you can like look at these tiny copepods and then also see your hand and trace them and not like get a headache. Cause like I also wear glasses. And so like I'd be trying to look through the microscope with my glasses on. Your like face keeps hitting the microscope. I'm just like shook.
Yeah. So yeah, I really enjoy it. But like anything else, if you're doing only that for like a few weeks at a time, it becomes a job, you know, like anything else. And I will say like a single sketch, depending on like the leg or the appendage that I'm drawing, some are simple, like more simple, some are very complex, could take me anywhere from like 30 minutes to sketch that appendage under a microscope to maybe like 2 or 3 hours to sketch that one appendage under the microscope. And then there's, you know, how many appendages that I'm drawing. I'm probably doing like 10 to 20 drawings for, you know, 10 drawings for each species. If the males are there and the males look different, that could be like 20 drawings for each species. And so the sketches alone are maybe taking me 2 hours to do. And then I'm reducing those, and then I'm going over them in ink, which might take another hour. So maybe 3 hours per drawing, 10 to 20 drawings per species description. So the drawings add up pretty quickly and they take a while.
Yeah, drawing is time consuming.
Yeah.
So I try to break it up. Like I have to do all the sketches usually around the same time because I have this specimen under a microscope. And so I'll put the headphones on that I'm wearing now and I'll listen to some music and I'll just like sketch for like, you know, I'll do one appendage, then another. If I could do like 3 or 4 a day, that might be like 8 hours worth. I'm feeling pretty good. And then I'll spend a couple weeks doing all the sketches, maybe a week or two. And then when I do the inking, I'll break that up. Like I'll be working on other projects and then I'll be like, you know what? It's 3 or 4 o'clock. I'll leave work now and I'll go home or I'll go to another desk and I'll do, you know, two of my sketches to kind of get the final product. And so that's kind of nice. Maybe I'll go home and I'll have like a glass of wine and do, you know, ink 2 drawings. And then I can scan those into my computer and, you know, maybe spend 10 minutes touching them up in Photoshop to like erase a fingerprint or a little ink smear or crooked line that I made. And then I'll be done with that. And that'll be like my final product that I'll put into the publication.
That is such a process. And if Sharkies, if you haven't gone and seen the images in this publication, absolutely go look at it because the detail is really incredible. And you're right. Like this is it's a totally different field that I'm not used to. And a lot of people need to do is be extremely accurate, like you're saying, to be able to differentiate the different species. And so I have go ahead.
I was just going to say, what's cool about it is people will go back to these papers for, you know, dozens of years, maybe like centuries into the future. Because when I'm working on like describing a new species, it could be that one species in this genus was described like 100 years ago. And I will go back and find, usually now like a scanned version of that paper that's online. And I will be looking at their drawing to be like, oh, does it have 5 spines on its second leg or 6? Because the one I'm looking on has 5. So these drawings are really important and really useful. And artists have definitely like upped the ante in recent years. If you go back like 100 years, there's some people that were really good illustrators, but they tended to do more like schematic type drawings, like a quick sketch, versus what we do now. These drawings can be like super detailed, and people even go back and take measurements from your drawings. Like if you didn't measure something and they think it might be what they're looking at might be important, like you put a scale bar next to each of your drawings so somebody can go back and be like, oh, this appendage was, you know, like just as long as it was wide. And now I'm looking at something similar, but it's twice as long as that, a different species. So the drawings are actually really important for that. And they are, you know, they're really fun to do. I really enjoy that like mixture of art and science, which is kind of rare.
So one thing that I didn't ask before that I should have is that this species that you're describing, the Pseudopanderis chirai, is it a problem for the shark? Like, is the shark suffering from having these parasites? We should definitely touch on that.
Yeah, good question. In the case of this parasite, not very much. I mean, all parasites kind of by definition have some negative effect on their host. This parasitic copepod has kind of like a piercing and scraping mouth parts. So its mouth is almost like a short version of like a mosquito's mouth. And it has like little kind of blade-like mouth parts that like feed into that. And so it's probably like scraping the shark skin and eating shark mucus and maybe shark blood. And so that does cause a little bit of damage and maybe makes it more likely that the shark gets some like secondary bacterial infection or something. But in general, like with this group of parasites, if you catch a shark that has them, it might have like 1 or maybe 5 individuals on its body. So if you're a shark that's like, you know, 3 feet long and you have, you know, 3 copepods that are each less than 1 centimeter long, it's like, you know, it's not doing very much harm. It's like if you had a few mosquitoes biting you or something, you're not gonna like really suffer from that. It might be slightly annoying.
I suffer from a couple mosquito bites. I just want to put that out there for the other listeners who die by mosquito bites every summer, because I am one of those people.
Yeah, they're probably better described as like a flea, you know. So if if you had a cat that only had like 3 fleas on it, you know, it's like your cat's like, you know, maybe slightly itchy, but not, you know, it's not gonna like die or probably have like significantly less babies because of that. Yeah.
Sorry. I have cats, and so I was just thinking about the fleas that I have experienced in my lifetime on my cats, and I was just remembering, this is totally off topic and we can cut it out, but I was remembering there was one time my cat blew, it was just like a particularly bad summer, and so we were having to like vacuum the house every day because of all the like flea dirt and the fleas, and my cat blew, walks into my room and just like threw his whole body on the ground, like rolling on the rug, I guess because he was itchy from the fleas. But it just made me think of that because it was such a weird behavior that I've never seen. And then my second thought was like, what if like sharks like breaching or something to get these parasites off?
Yeah, okay, so, well, we should totally leave this in because that's probably true. I mean, so there are like rays that jump out of the water. Nobody really knows why they do that. And people have suggested it could be trying to dislodge parasites. Certainly sharks go to like cleaning stations, right? Where like cleaner wrasse or shrimp will come and like pick through them. And those fish are probably looking for copepods and trying to remove them along with some other things. And in fact, the copepods that I'm describing in this paper are some of the only copepods that are pigmented. And people have suggested that that's actually a way the copepods are trying to like camouflage themselves on the shark so that cleaning fish don't see them as well.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, that's wow.
And one thing Yeah. And one thing I know I've seen is fish rubbing up against sharks. So people that have gone like diving or snorkeling may have seen this, where you'll see like a small fish swimming next to a shark and it will kind of like briefly like bump into it and rub its side against the shark. And that could be just what your cat was doing, like rub it, you know, rolling around on the ground. Like shark scales are really rough. And it could be that this fish is trying to like bump or like, you know, a parasite off of it or scratch an irritated area or something.
Sharks are great scratching posts, everyone.
Exactly. Yeah.
For fish, not for people, because shark burn is not fun. Yeah. If you get scratched by shark skin.
Shark burn is really rough. That is for sure.
So this paper is like, has so much morphology stuff in it, just in terms of like how copepods attach and their legs and the difference between male and females. And so you specifically described two different morphotypes in the paper. So I'm wondering if you could just tell our listeners what morphotypes are in the parasite world, and then various morphotypes that may be common, and what can cause, you know, variations in them.
Yeah, so I use that word in this paper to kind of just mean like there's two different, like, within this genus of copepods, there are kind of two main body types. So I called them morphotypes. You could also think of them as like forms. And I was trying to draw people's attention to the fact that like half of the species in this genus of parasites has one shape. They have this like long sort of shield, almost like a hard cape that's like covering their back. And the other half of the species, so another like three or four species in this genus, have a much shorter shield, and their kind of the segments of their body where they keep all their reproductive organs is much longer. And so I was kind of pointing this out because this was a really big morphological difference with among like what are thought to be closely related species. And so I think if we had more evidence, like if I was able to do more do some DNA sequencing of both of these shapes, like both of these morphotypes, and found that they made like two clades in a phylogenetic tree, I would split this genus then into two separate genera, because they're so visibly different. I mean, you don't even have to put them under a microscope, or you, at least you don't have to look at them very closely under a microscope to see that difference. So a lot of times people will use words like this, like forms or morphotypes, to describe like big morphological or anatomical differences within a group of closely related animals. So within this genus, there's two main shapes. And if we found out that those shapes reflect, you know, shared evolutionary history, I would split this genus into a second genus, and I would get, you know, I would name that second genus something else. I was thinking about that today. Like, the genus is called Pseudopandarus. That's because there's already a genus called Pandarus, and this looks kind of similar to it. So it's called Pseudopandarus. And I'm thinking, like, it's kind of funny. I don't know if I would actually do this, but if I split this into a second genus, I could call that like Pseudopandarus or something.
That would get confusing real fast.
Yeah. People, well, what I find even more confusing is sometimes people do things like you'll have Pandarus and then Pseudopandarus and then like Parapandarus, right? And Pseudopandarus and Parapandarus in like Latin or Greek are all meaning the same thing. They mean like similar to Pandarus. And so I actually think it would be more useful to have something called Pseudopandarus, because I'm saying like this is more similar to Pseudopandarus, not just to Pandarus. I don't know if I would actually do that because it's a little silly, but I think it would actually be helpful. So we'll see.
But then those morphotypes can still breed with each other, right? Do you know?
They actually can't. They can't. I don't think. So they're actually different species. So I'm kind of using morphotypes as being like forms of closely related species. Sure. So,
but you would have to do, I think you mentioned this in your paper, but you would have to do like more molecular or genetic work.
Exactly.
To actually prove that they're a different species.
Yeah. And I couldn't do that here because these copepods were collected in formalin, like formaldehyde. Yeah. And so that means they're like, it's really hard to do DNA sequencing with something that was preserved in formaldehyde. So I wasn't able to do that in this paper. I'm trying to think of like what an equivalent, you know, of these like forms might be for an organism that people might be more familiar with than like copepods. Okay. Well, like for instance, if you had like, sometimes it's color patterns, sometimes in this case, it's not color patterns, but like imagine you had a group of zebras that had like vertical stripes and then another group of zebras that had like horizontal stripes. Yeah. And there was like three species of each. And you're trying to decide like, should these be in different, are these forms, should they be in different genera or do they just have these different color patterns because they're like adapted to different habitats or a shared habitat or something like that. And so I'm using morphotype as like a form of closely related species that have some like, you know, yeah.
Yeah, different differences. Yeah. Yeah. And from your observations, do you notice any sort of benefit for those different morphotypes? Like why do they have these different morphotypes from your understanding?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't really know. In this case, one thing that I think could be part of it is the species that I described had this form or this morphotype where it has the big shield kind of on its back.
Like
almost
armor.
Almost like how, you know, like beetles have those like wing cases that like cover their back. It has these long, this long shield over its back. And that covers most of its eggs. So these copepods have like two strings of eggs. And it could be that that shield is like protecting those eggs. And it might be that it could be protecting them just from like getting bumped around, or maybe it's protecting them from like the cleaner fish that we talked about, because these egg strings can be like just as long as the body of the whole copepod. So maybe if fish comes around, cleaner fish comes around and it's not able to eat the whole copepod, but like it eats its eggs. In this case, the morphotype or the form with this long shield might be able to like shield or protect its eggs from an egg predator or something. That's really just a guess, but it could be, that could be the case.
That's really cool. Is there anything else from this paper that you want to touch on before we get to one of our favorite parts, which is field stories?
You know, I think you both did a great job of summarizing it. You know, I spent some time in the paper trying to talk about like why they might have these morphological patterns. In this case, I just had preserved like dead specimens. But, you know, one thing that I'm hoping to do down the line is bring like microscope adapters into the field. And I was thinking about getting a really good like macro lens for this, but I actually think that like the iPhone cameras are getting so good now that I could just use a microscope adapter. Because if you have to bring these big cameras into the field with big macro lenses, and then you need a computer and hard drives to do backups of all of these things, I'm like, now that things are getting so good on iPhones, you could just have your iPhone, do a computer backup and a cloud backup if you could get Wi-Fi, and then have all your images right there ready to go. And so I would like to try to do some kind of high speed photography in the future of these live copepods to see how they're using these different appendages to move around. And I think that could be really cool. There's some people that have done similar things, not with live specimens, but like they've removed the copepod while it was still attached to a piece of shark skin or shark scales. And then they've put that under like a scanning electron microscope. And they've seen like, oh, this weird claw actually fits perfectly onto a shark scale. We always thought this claw had such a weird shape. Why would it have that shape? Oh, turns out it locks into a placoid scale just like this, you know?
Oh,
so I think
so cool.
Having some, being able to do more stuff like that, like kind of, you know, functional morphology would be really cool for some of these parasites.
Yeah. Definitely.
And if for the sharkies out there that don't know this, like a lot of sharks, their dermal denticles, their scales are kind of like a fingerprint. Like if you had a dermal denticle, you could probably identify the species of shark based on the shape of the dermal denticle. So that actually makes sense, and probably also makes sense why you might find perhaps a copepod specialize maybe in a certain type of shark, because they fit, their body fits on a certain type of dermal denticle. Oh, that's so
cool. And it could, It could even be why some copepods live on particular areas of the shark, because their denticles will look different. Like the ones on the belly might be different than the ones on the lateral sides of the body, might be different than ones on the fins. And we definitely see that some of these copepods prefer certain areas, like the back of the pectoral fin. For some reason, you might find a bunch of copepods clustered there. And so it could be that those scales are better to hold on to, or maybe there's just less like shearing force on that part of the body or something. But clearly those are like important constraints for these parasites, especially if they're on like a fast swimming shark. Like, you know, if they get swept off their host, they're dead probably. So attachment to their host is really key.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, now I'm just thinking of all these different copepod shark skin questions.
I feel like we could do a whole other episode just on
there goes that. My next grant.
Well, a friend of mine, Ricky, I'll just mention, I'm going to give her a quick plug because she is working in Taiwan on like this type of question, like basically characterizing scales on different parts of like the bodies of sharks. And I was like, oh, it would be really cool if we could like work together someday to look at like the parasites and why they might attack, like, you know, do they fit these different areas of the shark's body where the scales are different too?
Yeah, my whole PhD is likely going to be comparing shark skin and dermal denticles like on single species in locations, but also across species depending on like what their lifestyle is and all of that stuff. So
it's super cool.
Shark skin is awesome.
So
before we close, this is our favorite part. We would like to ask you your favorite field story. And like you said, your field work can be like physically outside or it can be in the lab, so don't feel like your field story has to be restricted to you being outside.
I'm thinking of two stories and I'm trying to decide between them.
I mean, we'll listen to both.
Okay. One is really quick, but I think it's super cool because when I was working in Australia, we worked with these, fishermen, right? That they like make their money catching fish, but they're not like commercial fishermen the way that we would think about it, like going out on big boats. But this was probably the best collecting I've ever done because they had like the coolest way of catching fish that has like zero bycatch pretty much. So they have a small boat, they go to like a small island at high tide and they put a net, it's called funnel netting, and they put a net up against basically like the coast of the island out in maybe like 3 or 4 feet of water, ideally in an area where there's like a little channel. And so as the tide goes out, the fish follow this net. The net's basically built like a fence right around like a little part of the island. So as the tide goes out, the fish are trying to go into deeper water. They see this fence and they kind of move into a little funnel structure. And as it gets to low tide, the fishermen just close off that net with like a little piece of net in the back. And so now you have a small area, maybe like 10 or 20 feet long, that has like a ton of fish packed into it, but they're still in the water, still swimming around. And then the fishermen just take big fish nets, like a big net, and like scoop out the fish, put them onto like a sorting board on their boat, and they can perfectly sort out like, okay, these are the size we want, this is a fish we want, and they can keep only what they want and everything else is still alive, and they just throw it right back into the water. So it was this awesome system, and we would just meet them out there like an hour before low tide in our boat, and we would just ask them for stuff that they basically weren't gonna sell, so things that they would normally throw back, and we'd be like, hey, can we have some of those? Oh, we haven't seen that fish yet, can we have one of those to bring back to the lab to look at its parasites? And it was just this like super efficient scenario where we get to like process a ton of fish and like nothing goes to waste. So it was such a cool fishing scenario. And I actually named a species of copepod after John and Dave, the two fishermen, because like helped us collect all of these parasites. Awesome. So I have a lot of great stories of working with fishermen. The other one, this is probably my favorite field story. It was my first field trip and I was working in a fjord in Chile. And I will say it was like a rough day, but in fjords are pretty sheltered. So like anybody that's been out in like deep sea vessels will laugh at me for saying it was a rough day, but we're in a tiny boat out on the fjord. It's very choppy. and we're collecting some lines that we had put into the water the day before. And first of all, we're pulling up sharks that look like shark skeletons. Like, you know, in like cartoons when a cat like eats a fish and they like pull the bones out of their mouth and it's like a fish head in the skeleton. That's what we were pulling up because there were these amphipods that live on the bottom of the fjord. And I guess they're like dermestid beetles. And they were like, if the shark or the fish had died, they would eat everything like within hours. So sometimes you would like pull up a fish or a small shark and it would literally be the skeleton, or you'd be like, oh, this one's whole, and it would be the skin, and inside was filled with these amphipods that had like eaten everything. So we're not getting anything that we want. Like, everything has been eaten by these little scavenging like piranha amphipods. And it's stormy and it's pretty choppy, and the motor doesn't start. Like, the motor dies on the boat.
No.
And I'm like looking how far the fjord is off to the side. And I'm like, could we swim if we had to do this? And the guy running the boat, I guess he worked at the field station. He just is like, you know, he says in Spanish to like hand him the oar. And it, because apparently he figured out the fuel pump was broken. And so I hand him like the wooden oar on the boat. And I'm like, crap, is this guy going to have to like row us in? Like,
oh,
I don't think
gosh.
He would be able to. We were kind of like far away. And he just takes a knife out of his pocket and he like cuts an inch sliver of wood off the oar. And then he has like rubber fishing gloves on, and he cuts a finger off of the rubber fishing glove. And he puts this wooden splinter into the tip of his finger of the fishing glove. And he uses that to plug a hole in the fuel pump. And then he starts the fuel pump and it works perfectly fine. And he drove us back to dock with that. And it was amazing. And
my gosh.
Yeah. It was like, so like the ingenuity was amazing.
That is such like incredible problem solving.
Yeah, what the heck?
I mean, like, honestly, that is like my worst nightmare, is getting like left out to sea. If like, because honestly, we've had something similar happen where the engine wasn't turning on right away and we were just like in a bay. We were fine. But like, I can't. Oh, that would be so terrifying.
Stuck in the San Francisco Bay. A story by Megan Holes.
I would be fine. Coast Guard would just push us back in like 2 seconds and be like...
Yeah, so it was great. And like, so then we were trying to like, we were all like applauding this guy, right? And my friend Maria was there. There's like maybe four scientists, you know, four of us scientists on the boat, and this guy, like our driver. And so my friend Maria, who probably spoke Spanish the best, was like trying to explain. She was like, you're like MacGyver. And he didn't know what MacGyver was. So she was like explaining in Spanish. She's like, MacGyver, he's like this guy on TV where like, you know, all he has is gum and a piece of paperclip, and he could like make a bomb to like get out of any situation. And so for like the rest of the time when we were at that field station, we called him MacGyver.
Because I mean, he like saved
the
day.
Fantastic.
He earned that title 100%.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Oh, that did not disappoint. Thank you so much for that field story. I am so grateful for your MacGyver fisherman that you were able to make it back okay. And thank you so much, Dr. Bernat, for being here with us and talking about parasites and the relationship with sharks. It's just such an interesting field, and I'm so glad we got an opportunity to talk with you.
Yeah, well, thank you, Megan and Imani. This has been so much fun, and I appreciate all the work that you're doing on this podcast and helping teach people about sharks and now shark parasites, which are my favorite. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, sharkies out there. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Make sure to follow Dr. Bernat, and where can they find you if they want to do so?
I'm most active on Twitter, but I'm also on Instagram and TikTok, and at all of those places, it's just at Jimmy Bernat, J-I-M-M-Y, and my last name, B-E-R-N-O-T. So you could follow me there for weird parasite stuff and just like cool things that I find along the way.
Thank you so much, Sharkies. Make sure to follow Dr. Bernat, and until next time,
swim you later.